Please be seated. Good afternoon. We're delighted to welcome you all, but especially students from Roncalli. Would they please stand? Well, thank you for coming this afternoon. You may be seated. These students are here with a program run by the State Bar and this court called Court with Class. Students from around the state are invited to attend an oral argument. And if the invitation is accepted, the students come and they've been given materials about this case. And usually the students come in the morning and then meet with a member of this court. Did they meet with you, Justice Prosser?
My colleague, yes.
Good. And at that time, a discussion is had about the processes and procedures that the court follows in handling these cases, but not the substantive issue of the case. If anyone would like a synopsis or summary of the case we are about to hear, we're delighted to give you one. It's easier to understand the oral argument if you know something about the facts and legal issues. Would anyone like a summary? Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice Prosser, whom you've already met. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Brooks. To his left, Justice Patience Robinsack. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. Making those introductions, we'll now hear our third case for the day. And let me just check the lineup. It's State versus Conger, 08-8-755-CR. Mr. Frymuth, representing the state of Wisconsin, will argue 10 minutes. Mr. O'Malley, representing Mr. Conger, will argue for 13 minutes. Ben Kempinen of the University of Wisconsin Law School, representing the amicus, will argue for 10 minutes. Where's Mr. Kempinen? Okay, good. Attorney Patricia Wheeler of Godfrey Kahn will argue 20 minutes, representing Judge Grimm, and then 5 minutes for Mr. Frymuth and 2 minutes for Mr. O'Malley, right? Okay, we will begin with you, Mr. Frymuth.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General James Frymuth, representing the state as co-appellant. This Fond du Lac County drug case is in a pretrial posture and is before this court on certification by the Court of Appeals after it accepted Defendant Conger's petition for leave to appeal. The ultimate issue is whether the trial court erred or did not err in rejecting a plea agreement that reduces one Class H felony and one Class C misdemeanor to 3 unclassified misdemeanors, whose penalties would put them between Class A and B misdemeanors. The state's position distills to the following 5 holdings. First, a trial court must accept a proffered plea agreement unless it is unlawful. And unlawful is a shorthand expression of the standard set forth in the state's brief that I'll also get into in a minute. 2, the present plea agreement is lawful, and the trial court therefore should not have rejected it. 3, a trial court may not solicit law enforcement views or reject a plea agreement as being contrary to such views. 4, an appellate court should apply the same standard as a trial court, reviewing a plea agreement only for lawfulness. And 5, a trial court is not automatically obliged to recuse itself upon rejecting a plea agreement. However, Judge Grimm's status as a party on appeal may now require his recusal by statute, unless his position is perhaps recast as an amicus. A judge cannot be a party in the same action. With respect to trial court review, and the state's position, again, a trial court must accept a plea agreement unless it is unlawful. A plea agreement is unlawful only if the prosecutor has wholly failed to consult with any crime victims and consider their interests as required by statute, or if the prosecutor has evinced some improper discriminatory motive, or if the terms of the plea agreement are otherwise unlawful as a matter of statutory, constitutional, or common law. Stated another way, so long as the prosecutor has identified entirely lawful reasons for entering into the plea agreement, the trial court may not substitute its view of the public interest for that of the prosecutor. The wisdom of a specific plea agreement, including its possible deterrent, punitive, and rehabilitative effects, is for the prosecutor, not the trial judge, to assess. Although both defendant Conger and the amicus, Professor Kempinen, have articulated the standard for trial court review as whether the prosecutor erroneously exercised discretion in negotiating the plea agreement, the state is concerned that such language may not go far enough in protecting prosecutorial authority to enter into plea agreements. Substantively, we all may be intending the same limitation on trial court review of plea agreements, but the language variation is somewhat concerning.
I ask, from what you just outlined, you recall a couple of years ago there was some corruption involving a prosecutor in Winnebago County. Suppose the judge had gotten wind of that. Where does that fit into your analysis?
That would be the improper discriminatory motive. Usually that's intended to protect defendants, but it also could be more broad to concern the entire validity of the fairness of the system, the validity of the system. The example you're giving that you can't purchase your freedom or your justice.
But I assume in that case the prosecutor was smart enough to give reasons for any plea bargain before the court.
It would have to, right, and it may not be visible at the time, perhaps, of the plea. It would have to be something, perhaps, it could be something discovered later. It's a difficult proposition because among the reasons why prosecutors should have the final say here is they're going to know the strength or weakness of their case, for example, and they can't always disclose on the record the weaknesses, because if the case were to come back with plea withdrawal, then they're in trouble. So I don't think it's a fail-safe 100-proof system, but I think at least up front, that would be the state's position, that it would have to be one of these. I think it helps to have this a clearer standard than just erroneous exercise of discretion, because if it's unlawful, it's a clearer standard, I think, to apply. The unlawfulness may, as you suggest, arise after the plea agreement, but that just depends, I guess, on when that's discoverable.
Well, in effect, you're saying under erroneous exercise of discretion, you only look to the law part, not the fact part. Because usually in erroneous exercise of discretion, is there an error of law?
That can be.
And
correct.
Are the facts correctly stated, and is there a rationale? So you don't want the facts and the rationale. You just want the legal standard.
It has to be, yeah. The reason I'm suggesting lawfulness rather than erroneous exercise of discretion is, once you say erroneous exercise of discretion, even though you're suggesting that the prosecutor is better positioned than the trial court to make that determination of the public interest, you're still leaving the door open, perhaps, to variations among trial courts saying, well, I think this is not a proper exercise of prosecutor discretion. I don't think it informs you as well as saying that a plea agreement that is unlawful for some clear reason.
Mr. Frymuth, your suggestion would seem to indicate to me that you're asking us to overrule Gunther, to overrule Kenyon, to ignore to a major extent, the language from those cases. Is that correct?
I think what it not necessarily. I think what it does is to give meaning to the public interest that was left amorphous, if you will, or left open in those cases. I realize that sometimes it's hard to know precisely what is or is not the public interest or what factors may come into play, but I think if you make the standard that lawfulness, that makes it a much clearer standard to apply, as I suggest. And I think it means, in other words, what I'm trying to say is public interest means that it's a lawful plea agreement.
Doesn't your approach sort of say public interest means whatever the prosecutor decides?
In large part, that is correct. I think, and there, I'd like to, if I may, articulate a variety of reasons why I believe that should be the case. But that is correct. That's what we are suggesting. First, just by nature of their respective roles, the prosecutor is better positioned than the trial court, as I said, to know the strengths and weaknesses of the case. Can't disclose that always on the record because the case could come back and go to trial. Secondly, prosecutorial resources are limited, and that's a very real concern as the numbers the Legislative Audit Bureau recently assembled. That's in the state's reply brief. Prosecutors simply cannot afford to take every case to trial or even very many cases. If a trial court is limited to reviewing a plea agreement for lawfulness, then the ability to negotiate a plea agreement affords the state, the defendant, crime victims, and the public a largely prompt, ensured disposition or resolution of a case.
When you say plea agreement, you're talking about that portion of the plea agreement that deals with the reduction of the charge?
Reduction of a charge could be a sentence recommendation. Those are the two primary aspects of plea agreements that occur. Agreements actually may produce an overall punishment maximizing effect in a broader sense of the public interest. That is, more offenders are brought to justice and made answerable for their crimes, while prosecutors accomplish a time savings that can be applied to other, perhaps more serious or contentious cases. Plea agreements can enable prosecutors to enlist offenders as informants, a scenario that, again, may limit a full public explanation of a plea agreement. Every charging decision, whether or not amended by a plea agreement, places some restriction on a trial court's sentencing powers simply by the choice of charges in the first instance. Giving trial courts relatively free rein to reject plea agreements runs counter to the established principle that courts may not participate in plea negotiations. Giving trial courts relatively free rein to reject plea agreements based on their own personal views of the public interest could cause the public interest standard to vary from judge to judge, increasing forum shopping and hampering the prosecutorial need to negotiate plea agreements in the first instance. Giving courts relatively free rein to reject plea agreements could push plea bargaining to the pre-charging setting where sufficient information about a particular case may not be known or knowable. And I see my time is up already, so.
But you're not suggesting that the judge has to accept the plea agreement, are you?
Unless it is unlawful in the sense of ignoring the victim's rights as required by state.
But the many plea agreements also have a sentence recommendation.
True.
The judge can reject that, can't he?
I'm suggesting not that he can't substitute his view of the public.
Even
interest.
On the sentence recommendation? That's what you're suggesting? That's really contrary to a whole load of cases, in addition to the ones that Justice Crooks mentioned that said you had to have, you have to give the judge full information so that the judge can sentence appropriately, et cetera. You're just taking away, I can see the plea, I can see the charging decision as the prosecutor's.
But not
the sentence.
The trial court, of course, isn't bound by any sentence recommendation, so.
That's what I'm asking you. They're not bound.
I misunderstand that, but yeah, they're
so
not
all
bound
the
by
judge
a sentence
can, all the judge can do is say, hey, I'm not taking the sentencing.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
Okay.
No.
So the judge has to take the plea.
You're right. Where the trial court's interest, public interest concern comes in is in the sentencing. But that sentencing, of course, is limited by whatever the plea agreement
is. Plea is, of course.
That's what.
That was my next question.
I'm sorry.
Okay, got it.
Apologize.
Thank you.
It's been a long morning.
No problem. I know. Mr. O'Malley? I think this is the first time in my career I've seen the state and the defendant sit on the same side of the table.
I'm Anthony O'Malley. I represent Joshua Conger, who happens to be here today. I proudly represent him. May it please the court. It may be that we're both on the same side because of the justice of the cause that that I'm representing. And I think it's a correct cause. When I first took this case, I was inspired by a favorite passage I have from Shakespeare, where he says that earthly power shines like God's power when mercy tempers justice. And that is what I tried to do in this case for my client, Joshua Conger. I sought some mercy for him, and for some good reasons. I didn't want to see this young man saddled with a felony conviction so early in his life, at a time in his life when he really didn't see and didn't appreciate the doors that could be closed to him from his actions. It affects his ability to become involved in the military service. Certain licenses could not be provided to him. His Section 1, Article 25 right to bear arms would be impacted. His right to vote in many states where he could leave Wisconsin would be taken away from him for the rest of his life. His ability to attain a job, to get student financing for higher education or training, to support his young family. In that connection, Joshua had many good attributes. Besides his youth, he was 22 at the time of this case was started. He had stable employment, and he's maintained that stable employment. He provided for his fiancée and his young son during this period of time. At the time, he was cooperative with the investigators. He had obtained counseling after his arrest for his marijuana addiction. He had no prior juvenile or criminal record. He had done well while he was on bail, and he continues to do well on bail. He accepted supervision as part of the plea agreement, and he also accepted the repeater status that the plea agreement would provide for. He understood that going in, he would be facing jail as a consequence of his actions, and he was willing to accept that consequence. It was up to 18 months for the three misdemeanors that was part of the plea agreement. I asked the state to season justice with mercy, and it agreed. And our plea bargain was the result. I didn't expect that I'd have to negotiate with the judge over it, though. And that's basically what happened when we got into the plea approval process. We had three hearings, and in those hearings, the court was, I believe, mostly concerned in what the police officers thought about the case.
As I understand it, the two police officers that were involved with the arrest were no longer part of the MEG unit. What was the response, ultimately, of the MEG unit with regard to this case?
I did not speak to the MEG unit myself, but my understanding is that those officers preferred to see referred felonies, kept as referred as felonies, and weren't particularly and like to see them kept that way. In that connection, I understood what the state had indicated to the court was they were not in favor of this particular plea agreement because it went against that.
Their general policy of felonies shouldn't be reduced.
Excuse me?
It went against law enforcement's general policy or belief that felonies should not be reduced to misdemeanors.
Yeah, and I think that's a general feeling, and it differs amongst different police officers. But in that particular case, I think that was the case.
Mr. O'Malley, let me tell you what a problem that I'm having with your argument. Not your argument today, but you and Mr. Freiman. As a trial court judge, you're given guidelines. You're told you need to dispose of cases within X amount of days. You're supposed to do things with dispatch. You need to run a fair, orderly courtroom. You have thousands of cases you're trying to process. So you do that as meaningfully as possible and try to get the cases that need to be tried, tried, and the ones that aren't going to be tried, disposed of otherwise. So, for example, as a trial court judge, you might set a final status date in a case where you say, you know what? Any plea agreements, any deals, anything you're going to work out between yourself, of course, I'm not bound by that, but has to be done by that date. After that date, you're set for trial. Case shouldn't be dismissed. Case should proceed on. You're welcome to go ahead and go to trial, right? And then you really do weed out the cases that are going to plead versus the cases that really need to be tried. And it seems to be a pretty fair way of dealing with things. And then you end up having a significant amount of trials, but you don't have wasted trial dates. You don't have juries that come in, and then someone pleads at the last minute, and they came in for no reason at all. So part of what I'm struggling with here is a judge would no longer be able to have any sort of ability to monitor cases. You'd just have to stack 20 trials on a day and hope one goes. Milwaukee County functions that way, but a lot of smaller counties don't. So it wouldn't be a very workable standard for a number of smaller counties where you really do want the cases that need to be tried, tried, and the cases that need to plead, plead. Because after that status date, people could just come in under your logic and say, you know what, I know we're set for trial today, Judge, but we decided we want this to be a disorderly conduct instead of a, who knows what, substantial battery, and so here's our plea agreement. What's the judge do? You called in a jury just for this case. You had 15 other cases you didn't call up. You have wasted resources. You have 15 cases now to reschedule. And the judge has to go along with a disorderly conduct plea and a wasted day where nothing's happening in court. That's part of, I'm just giving you the reality of the situation, how it ties judges' hands. You got to help me through that.
Well, I'm not sure it would tie the judge's hands any more than a looser standard. In fact, I think the looser standard, for instance, in the case we have right now, Judge Grimm decides that the plea agreement that's mutually agreeable to the parties must continue on to trial, basically. So you haven't corrected the problem with the de novo review that Judge Grimm has applied here. In fact, you've continued that case to create the same problem that you're concerned about right now. And that's going to happen more and more.
No, my concern is your case is advanced for trial. You come in at the final status. You tell me we are firm for trial. We need our trial date. I let 15 other trials go, and I call in a jury just for you. And on the day of trial, you come in and you say, you know what? We negotiated this deal. We don't need a trial today. That's the problem.
Well, and as I understand what you're saying is, and I guess what you're saying is that you think a judge should be able to say, sorry, even though you've resolved this, you got to use this trial I have here.
Because you're given a chance and you're given a final status and you say, nope, we cannot. We've done everything we can do. We've talked. We cannot resolve this case. We are the ones who need a trial. Put every other case, every other victim, every other situation off to the side and try our case. Take all the resources and time and energy and effort and the jury and the citizens and the witnesses and everyone else and put them up front today because we need it. And then you come in on that day and say, oh, we reached a plea deal. You got to take it, Judge. You don't have any discretion.
Well, I'm assuming that in the situation you're talking about, if it went to trial, that day would still be used for the trial. The witnesses and all the people would be there to do the trial. The jury would be there. And in a plea agreement, even at that late date, would basically send all the jurors home, would give the court that time to work on other matters.
The but you know what? You had 15 cases set for trial on that day. Any one of those victims or people would have wanted their case resolved. Now they're all set. I mean, you don't understand the backlog, the incredible backlog it takes to reschedule those cases time and time and time again. It's a real rub with your argument, at least with me.
Well, I don't think an alteration of the standard of review would would change that. Because, quite honestly, I question whether it's really appropriate for a judge to force a case that's resolved to go to trial, even though the parties don't want to try it. What I find interesting about my research in this area is that this same rule applies in civil cases. Yet, in my experience, I've never seen a court have a hearing to determine the public interest in a civil case, even though that is the law, and it applies to both criminal and civil cases based on the research I did. So you have, essentially, I think judges are applying the standard we're proposing, certainly in civil cases, and most of the time, they're applying that standard already in criminal cases. It's unfortunately that in this particular case, the standard shifted, I believe, and it shifted to the de novo standard, and I don't think that's a proper standard in this case. This court has already established in some case law what is the proper procedure that should be applied in the case of a plea. And basically, it is determined that when there's a move for the prosecutor to produce a charge or reduce a charge in the complaint, it's proper, though not mandatory, that the court ascertain why the plea was reduced. And basically, it's the determination based on that information is what is the propriety of any proposed reduction. And I think that's where we're talking about the standard we're looking at, is if it's a proper, lawful, as Mr. Feidmuth indicated, basis for the reduction, then it should be allowed. There's been some concern I've heard is that sometimes there's talk about if you assert the jurisdiction of the court, now you've given the court control over these matters. And the fact of the matter is that just asserting the court's jurisdiction by the filing of the charge does not necessarily mean that the prosecutor loses its discretionary acts and has to be reviewed at a de novo level. For instance, under 971-29-1, the prosecutor can amend or even dismiss the charges without leaving court at any time prior to the arraignment. This court has held that you can have the arraignment, if it hasn't been done previously, even after all the evidence and while the jury is deliberating. So essentially, under the law of the case, cases this court has had, essentially there's no restriction in those types of cases for an amendment or even a dismissal and requires no leave of court.
Mr. O'Malley, my understanding of the record here is that Judge Grimm gave approximately 7 or 8 reasons why he was rejecting the plea agreement. Are there any particular of those reasons that you take issue with? Any of them that you think were improper or inappropriate or not reasons that were valid under the circumstances of this case?
If they were being proposed by a prosecutor, I think they would be valid reasons for not reducing. I believe those were prosecutorial reasons. Those were the reasons that the prosecutor looked at and apparently rejected in this case, and looked at other reasons and decided to go with the reduction in this case. So they're all valid reasons, but they were just being applied by the wrong public official. It should have been the prosecutor looking at those, and I believe the prosecutor in this case, in fact, did look at those. I think there was some discussion about that. So I think the prosecutor looked at those, rejected them, chose other more compelling reasons to provide for this reduction of the felony to a misdemeanor. There are plenty of cases or statutes in Wisconsin that allow for a reduction or dismissal without leave of court after filing charges and after arraignment. A good example of that is deferred prosecution agreements under 971.37 involving child sexual abuse, domestic violence, violating a restraining order. There's no requirement for a leave of court. The prosecutor can enter into that deferred prosecution agreement. There's no requirement that it be approved by a court. And in the section dealing with the dismissal of the case or the reduction of case, it says the judge shall terminate the case at that point and dismiss the case. Yes, ma'am.
Your red light is on. Do you have a summary statement you want to make, a summary sentence?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Malley. Mr. Kempinen?
Good afternoon. I'm Ben Kempinen, a clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School. I want to thank the court and also thank the intervener respondent, Judge Grimm, for allowing me to appear before you today. For the past 30-plus years, I have been a student of and to a certain extent a participant in our criminal justice system in Wisconsin and have a keen interest and I hope somewhat of a unique perspective on the issue in this case that I hope the court may find of some value. Whose view of the public interest should guide a trial court's decision to either accept or reject a proposed settlement of a criminal case is the issue in this case. If the prosecutor's view of the public interest controls, then the issue becomes one of prosecutorial discretion, and I think the appropriate standard is the court to determine whether or not the prosecutor relied on appropriate factors. If so, the decision should be approved, even if the judge, had he or she been in the role of prosecutor, would have chosen differently. Should this court adopt this view, the trial judge's ruling below is wrong and should be reversed. In my experience in visiting courthouses around the state and in practicing, this is the correct and, in my view, the most common application of the public interest standard. I think it also is the view that is most consistent with the role of the contemporary prosecutor today in Wisconsin and elsewhere. On the other hand, if the judge's view of the public interest controls, then it becomes a question of judicial discretion. And if it's judicial discretion, judicial oversight becomes judicial assumption of the charging power, a power that this court has acknowledged as a shared power with the executive, and the court's decision below should be affirmed if the court believes it's a question of judicial discretion. I would submit to the court that if this decision is that the judge ultimately should apply their own view of the public interest, that many trial judges in the state are not doing so and are abdicating their responsibility to prosecutors.
Counselor, should it make a difference that this was the change in the charges, the reduction in charges that the prosecutor sought occurred after an information was filed rather than at an earlier part of the proceeding? For example, if a complaint had been filed and then it had been amended right away, there's no need to get the court involved, but should we look at that? Should that be a factor?
Well, I think that's relevant. I would suggest that there's a wide range of statutes that suggest legislative control over, as the court knows, the court and the prosecutor. One of them is 97129, dealing with obtaining leave of court after an arraignment. It seems to me a consistent way of balancing the interests of both constitutional officers would be to apply the same abuse of discretion review. To be honest with you, I'm not completely comfortable with the notion of figuring out ways to evade review or public transparency in decisions, whether they be before or after arraignment, but I think, in my view, in terms of what is the best policy, it doesn't make a difference. On the other hand, under the statute, clearly before an arraignment, leave of court isn't required. Afterward, it is. In fact, knowing that, many DAs I've talked to around the state say one way to evade the judges that they expect will not agree with an agreement is to simply make sure that the information is filed or the negotiation occurs before an arraignment.
Well, you know, I don't know how things are in Milwaukee County, and I've not been practicing now for, 14 years almost. But in Milwaukee County, they used to have a charging conference. If you went in with your client, they weren't even charged. And you on certain types of cases, certainly not all. And certainly there was a lot of discretion there where the prosecutor may say, you know, we could charge this, but we're not going to charge this, and so on and so forth. So, you know, that may not be transparent either, but I think that kind of discretionary power by the prosecutor has always gone on. I think here what we're seeing is a judge who feels perhaps he was not shouldering his part of the process by agreeing to something that he thought was not appropriate.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's clear. And one thing I would perhaps emphasize, I don't think anybody on any side of this case would suggest other than that all of our state trial judges and all of our state prosecutors do their very best every day to serve the community and serve the interest in public safety. I think the question, a more difficult question, is whose call is it to make in different situations?
Right. And how does the trial judge shoulder his part of that responsibility, which obviously the legislature clearly put him in the mix of when you have to get the court's approval before you can do what was recommended here?
That is true. I would suggest a careful reading of the range of statutes, be it the John Doe statute, the statute about changing arraignments, the statute on accepting the plea. I would suggest that a court may accept or leave of court is required, mm-hmm. but often what's left unstated and left unstated in discussions of the public interest standard in applying that standard, in discharging that responsibility, what factors should I consider? What deference, if any, is owed to the prosecutor? For reasons I've stated in my brief, and I can expound on briefly, I believe the best policy is to defer to the elected prosecutor.
Mr. Kempman?
Yes, excuse me.
You heard Justice Siegler's questions to Mr.
Yes.
O'Malley. Do you have any different answers to her concerns?
Well, I certainly would not suggest to you that I have solutions to Milwaukee's problems. With respect to, though, the question of the stacking of trials and last-minute plea agreements, a couple of observations. Number one, I don't think whatever standards chosen here is responsive to that issue. Number two, I think a core responsibility and power of the court is to try to do what you can to control your calendar. What I have seen effective in some communities here and elsewhere in dealing with that is to achieve sort of a voluntary session of power, if you will, between prosecutor and court. I think the DA has the most control in this situation, and if the DA agrees that after a date certain there aren't any changes in the agreement, we as lawyers are trainable, even though patience is required, and sometimes defense attorneys will realize there won't be a deal after that point. I know a number of years ago when I had an opportunity to observe and write about Milwaukee's misdemeanor court, Judge Dugan did that very thing. And I know many defense attorneys waltzed into court expecting a last-minute deal and were somewhat surprised to realize that when Judge Dugan said this is the day, he meant it. And there was some amount of grumbling, but there was an adjustment to that. Now, I've sort of lost track of that, but I think that there are ways to respond to that problem. I don't think the standard of review is necessarily one that does that.
Part of the problem is both sides are asking for a hard and fast rule that applies across the board in every situation. That's where the difficulty comes in, because I don't think it's the typical case, the case you have here. I don't think it's the typical case. I don't think that judges around the state more often than not reject the DA's amendment of charges. I think more often than not that's accepted. Having said that, I think it's the judge's responsibility to set the rules for how the courtroom's going to work and when you're expected to know if your case has reached an agreement or not, or whether you're going to trial or not. And I know you think DAs and people are trainable, and a lot of them are. I was trainable, but human nature also factors in. And if you can put something off to next week instead of dealing with it this week, because you know you can go in and you can force the judge's hand to accept a plea agreement, things will be delayed and they will be put off. That's just the way it works.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, but I really think that whether the judge says my belief of what the public interest is controls or the DA's, I think other responses are necessary to deal with what I think is an extraordinarily important and legitimate concern that you raise.
Counsel, with regard to the public interest, one of the concerns of the judge here was that to reduce felonies to misdemeanors decreases the morale of law enforcement. Is that a proper consideration?
You know, it seems to me that a prosecutor has to consider law enforcement, victims, the defendant's interests, the community at large. There's a complex of interests. I think it's something that the prosecutor ought to consider.
What about a judge? Now, those words seemed a little unusual for me in a sentencing transcript.
Well, you know, ultimately my view, and it's based
in a transcript like this,
right? In part on separation of powers, I think that that's a factor that the prosecutor needs to consider, and I think ultimately his or her decision as to whether that is controlling or not is their decision. I think that is an appropriate balancing. I think the judge. Basically, in a case like this, and I would say, maybe stepping back from it, with respect to approval of a plea agreement, I see agreements as having four basic components. One is, will there be an amendment of charges? Two, will there be a dismissal of charges? Three, is there a sentencing recommendation? And four, what plea should be entered, be it no contest, Alford, or guilty? I think Ginther and the DA's authority should be limited to the first two questions. That is, whether the plea agreement would involve basically an amendment or dismissal. It seems to me the judge's autonomy in deciding the sentence and what plea to accept is established, and at least my position would be that ought not be viewed as part of the prosecutor's authority. That said, it seems to me that if the prosecutor concludes that I think this is appropriate, and the law enforcement doesn't agree, it's not law enforcement's call to make under our system.
It's not what?
It's not law enforcement's decision. It seems to me that the ultimate decision lies with our prosecutor. And I might, if I may, I think that this case is certainly not only important to the parties, and I see my time is up.
Time is up,
and my students would love to have a red light on the podium in class.
Finish up your thought.
Well, if I may, and I might just a final thought suggest to the court, I think our separation of powers analysis in past cases has failed to accommodate or consider the fact that there has been an extraordinarily profound change in the public prosecutor since the time of our Constitution, since the time of the statutes that seem to be at the core of many of the decisions. And I think a failing, perhaps, of prior advocates before this court has to not share with the court the dramatic change that prosecutors have undergone since
What's
the time.
What's that change?
Well, I think number one, for example, at the time of statehood, prosecutors were a somewhat lesser figure at the county level, viewed as less important than the sheriff or the coroner. I think what we have seen is, and I think reflected in certainly the American Bar Foundation's research in the 1950s, guided by late Frank Remington, by the crime studies in the 20s and 30s, that the prosecutor has emerged to become a central figure in the criminal justice system. That, I submit to you, is a reality of the system we have today. And it's a reality that has been supported by our electorate. It is not by mistake that the prosecutor is a county official and that this expanded role has been supported by the citizens that keep electing prosecutors. There is a power that they exercise, a power that I think has been approved by the electorate, and in a power which I think is not clearly acknowledged in some of the cases of this court. In my view, that a more appropriate balancing of the interests would accommodate a consideration of the role of the prosecutor today, rather than, as I think the court has perhaps become fixated on an unnamed defendant in earlier cases, on the legislative structure of our county level government perhaps more than 100 years ago. But again, thank you very much for your time.
You're not done yet, because I have a question, Mr. Kempinen. you, Mr. Kempinen?
Yes. Oh, okay.
You don't take the position that the prosecutor is totally exempt from review?
No, absolutely not.
Your position is that the, if I understand it correctly, the trial court judge will review the press, can review it for an erroneous exercise of discretion.
I think, yes. In those
I don't understand what that means. What does the prosecutor have to show to the judge to show that it's not an erroneous
I would suggest if the question is a plea agreement, if the question is a move to amend after an arraignment, the judge can simply say, why are you doing what you're or suggesting what you're asking me to approve? And I think by the same token, the prosecutor has a responsibility in a transparent public forum to say, these are the factors I considered. These are the manner in which I weighed them, whether it be talking to law enforcement, satisfying victims' rights, balancing the other interests. And it seems to me that transparent discussion or disclosure of reasons provides a vehicle for those who this court has said ultimately selects DAs, the electorate, to basically understand how those elected officials are exercising their power.
Well, the state says, well, they not might not want to say, hey, our witness is in a coma at the moment, our main witness is in a coma, or our main witness is perfectly competent, but will make a lousy witness, you know.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, there's certain lawyer code word that works there. There's some concerns about the case of what that nature. But it seems to me in the mine run case, the basic reasons that the prosecutor is balancing ought to be disclosed.
Well, what about I've got too much work, so I'm going to serious felony to a disorderly conduct?
If that's the best the prosecutor can offer, then I would suggest that that would be a situation where improper factors have infected the decision and the court would be well-grounded in refusing to accept that. That would also be an explanation that I would imagine the electorate would keep in mind in the next election cycle. My view would be that ultimately, if it's simply a matter of a disagreement over difficult issues, that in our system of three branches, and we shouldn't have, in my view, two branches in criminal cases. If it's three branches, that it's the call of the district attorney. And I might also mention, if I can, that one of the things, this issue manifests itself primarily in instances in which the judge believes a harsher disposition is appropriate. That's the reality of it. And I think a cost, and perhaps not a hidden cost, of allowing the judge's discretion to basically trump the DA's is I think it impairs the perception that the court is a neutral figure in the system. And I think that that's a cost that I think we get very little in return. You know, it seems to me that we are not appropriately acknowledging the hard work and thoughtfulness of most of our prosecutors when they present their vision of the public interest.
In the transcript in the blue briefs appendix, one of the reasons, and this was, I think, raised indirectly by Justice Crooks, one of the reasons the court said it was not going to take this plea agreement is, quote, the court believes that the public interest is not served by the reduction from felonies to misdemeanors. That sounded like to me like a flat rule this judge had. He goes on to say, it's not in the public interest to set a precedent or send a message to like-minded people who allegedly maintain drug trafficking place or allegedly possess large quantities with higher street values with intent to deliver. I think it unduly depreciates the offenses allegations or the seriousness of the allegations. If we did not take your view, is that an appropriate standard for the judge?
It seems to me that's an appropriate factor to consider, and that's an opinion that could reasonably be reached. My point, again, is that I don't think in that situation it's the judge's call to make. And I think to exercise that authority, merges, if you will, the executive and judicial power into one, and we become a system of two rather than three branches.
Thank you, Counsel. Ms. Wheeler, representing the Honorable Peter L. Grimm.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Patricia Wheeler. At counsel's table with me is Catherine Stadler. We represent Respondent Judge Peter Grimm. The Director of State Courts asked us to represent Judge Grimm in this matter because of the significance of the issues this case presents. Appellants ask this court to adopt a radical new standard, proposing that the trial courts of the state, exercising their independent duty of supervision, should give substantial deference to any plea bargain. So much deference, in fact, that only if the district attorney wholly fails to consider victims' interests or shows some improper discriminatory motive, should a court be able to disapprove the case's negotiated disposition. But that's not the law. Nowhere in this court's jurisprudence does the word deference appear in relation to the supervisory role of the judiciary over plea bargains. Since at least 1978, this court has vested in the trial courts the responsibility for an independent supervision of plea agreements. They must be in the public interest. Not in the public interest defined solely by the prosecutor, but the public interest defined by the court. The new standard of review sought by the appellants collides with a long line of decisions from this court. More importantly, it collides with the inherent authority of the judicial branch and a state statute. The law of Wisconsin makes it clear that the judiciary has both the independence and the responsibility to protect the public interest. In response to appellants' arguments, I'd like to address 2 points. First, that, and in response to Justice Crooks's comment, the state and Mr. Conger are, in fact, asking this court to overrule Kenyon. Their proposed standard represents a radical departure from 30 years of jurisprudence, establishing and affirming the duty of the trial court to independently evaluate plea agreements in the public interest. And second, the law as it exists today, as articulated by this court in Kenyon, and is properly applied in this case by Judge Grimm, remains an effective yet efficient check on the prosecutor's otherwise near limitless discretion.
There's I have two questions for you, Ms. Wheeler. First, can you move that microphone closer to you?
Certainly.
But I think that will help. Second, so I can listen to your argument with better understanding, you ceded time to Mr. Kempinet. Is your position the same as Mr. Kempinet?
It is not.
It is not. I wanted to make that clear. Tell me what the difference is.
The difference is Mr. Kempinen, along with the appellants in general, are proposing that this court adopt a new standard for trial courts to review plea agreements. The standard they're proposing comes much closer to the federal standard, giving much less discretion to the judiciary, and essentially allowing a judge to reject a plea agreement only in cases where the prosecutor has abused his discretion or somehow failed to follow the law.
And your view is a de novo by the judge of a plea agreement, in effect?
Our view is no. Our view is that the Kenyon case decided 30 years ago mandated that the court, in the public interest, independently review whether a plea agreement, in fact, met the public interest standard.
Could I follow up on that? Let's suppose you are a circuit judge. You've been a circuit judge for 5 years. An election next year. And I imagine over those 5 years, you probably approved a lot of plea bargains. Isn't that likely?
It's highly likely.
All right. I want to run against you. I'm going to go poring over those plea bargains and find all of the ones that I think are most odious. And I'm going to say, you know, ladies and gentlemen, Judge Wheeler had the ability to reject this one, and this one, and this one, but she approved every one of those in the public interest. Is that what you really want here?
I think that's what Kenyan mandates. I think that once arraignment occurs, the state of Wisconsin has made the decision that the responsibility to protect the public interest falls not only with the prosecutor, but also with the court. And I think you're absolutely correct that in probably 98-99% of the cases, a circuit court judge is going to agree with the prosecutor that the plea does meet the public interest standard, but that's not to say that the judge should be relieved of his or her duty to make that consideration.
Ms. Wheeler, when this case was certified to us by the Court of Appeals, one of the things they asked us to look at were the factors that should go into a weighing of the public interest. Do you have any suggestions in that regard?
I think that the state in its brief makes an extensive list of factors that courts should consider. However, I think Kenyon and subsequent cases that refer to Kenyon make it clear that the public interest can't be narrowly defined, can't be constrained to a list. And I think it's going to vary, as is every plea, based upon the particular factors at work in that instance.
Let me tell you, as a follow-up to Justice Crooks's question, what one of my concerns is with regard to the factors. As I read the three transcripts from the three hearings here, I came away with the impression that the most important factor is what does law enforcement think? And I can go and quote those different passages in the three hearings, but I won't. I'm just saying that was my impression. And then ultimately, when the court was at the end of the third hearing making its decision, one of the factors it considered was that it's not in the public interest, that's good because those are the words of the cases, to drop a felony to a misdemeanor because it decreases the morale of law enforcement. That's almost an anathema to me when you have a judge who is a fair and impartial decision maker. Using those words. Now, if it were at sentencing, I would say that's an improper factor. It's not a relevant, and if it's not relevant, it's improper, and therefore improper factor is an erroneous exercise of discretion. This isn't at sentencing, however. This is in deciding whether or not to accept a plea agreement. My question is whether dropping, as a general rule, dropping felonies to misdemeanors decreases the morale of law enforcement. Is that a proper consideration or factor for the court?
I think that in the public interest analysis, I think the prosecutor was clear that she considered the opinion of law enforcement as one of many factors. I think the judge you saw the theme through the three hearings because that was the one question the judge never really did get answered.
In fact, the judge said, I'm going to call them myself to find out.
The judge got nothing more in the third and final hearing than a general statement about, well, generally, the police don't like it when they bring us a felony and we reduce it to misdemeanors. But I think it's absolutely clear from the record that during the second hearing, during the December 7th, 2007 hearing, before the judge had any information about, even though it was just general information about the opinion of law enforcement, the judge said, if I had to decide right now, based on what we have, the answer is still no. I'm not going to accept it.
And then the rest of that sentence is, if I'm not going to accept it. But I have an open mind, and if the agency says this is a good plea bargain, that's a factor I'll consider.
Right.
And so that's what leads me to say in the three things, that was the, not just a factor, it was the most important factor.
Well, I don't, because we didn't really get an answer from the agency, I don't know what the impact of the agency saying I love this plea would have been, but the fact is he was ready, based upon the factors that he knew about from the first hearing, from at least the second hearing, to rule against this, to reject this plea, and nothing that he learned in the subsequent hearing about the police's the general view of police.
I'm not sure that that's my read, because he was told generally they don't like it, and then when you get to his decision, and I'm reading at the end of the transcript of page 145 of the transcript of the last hearing, this is where he's getting to his decision, and that's what he says too. He says, well, it's not a good idea to generally do felonies to misdemeanors because it decreases the morale of law enforcement. So I think he did, my read of it is that he did pick up on that general statement.
I think that he probably came to, that's probably a conclusion that he could have come to from having spent 19 years on the bench. I don't think that it was anything specific to this case. I think that it's not an unreasonable assumption to make that law enforcement might prefer that cases they bring in as felonies are charged as felonies. But again, I think that the judge made clear on the record, having gone through the Kenyon factors, what he considered as part of his public interest analysis. I believe he considered essentially the same factors that the prosecutor did, but they ended up being weighed somewhat differently.
Well, let me,
I think Kenyon requires the court to do that.
I was going to look at the factors. He said nature. He looked at the nature of the facts within the criminal complaint. He said he looked at the preliminary hearing transcript. Said the state got a search warrant, which was executed, and they found two large gallon-sized bags full of marijuana in the ceiling tiles of the bedroom, which he shared with his girlfriend. They found a digital scale. They found drug paraphernalia and large marijuana stems in a box of plastic sandwich baggies. The female roommate to the defendant made admissions to the officer that they were obtaining marijuana. He goes on and says, court believes the public interest is not served by the reduction from felonies to misdemeanors. I read that or hear that as saying no all the time. No felonies to be reduced to misdemeanors. Flat rules are generally not thought as a good exercise of discretion. So I was concerned about that. And he goes on, and I read that before about sending a message. He recognizes that felonies have different consequences. And I read that as saying, well, that's why he doesn't want to reduce a felony to a misdemeanor. He also says he rarely refuses a plea bargain, but this is one of the cases. He then goes on to say the offense is too serious for misdemeanor. Do you think that's a good reason?
I think that the interest in the public of having its laws enforced is one factor that this court has considered in as part of the public interest analysis. I think that the judge in this case for at least the reasons he cited on the record felt that 2 pounds of marijuana packaged clearly for sale in 48 little baggies reduced to three misdemeanors didn't express the gravity of this case, of the offense. A similar case that the Court of Appeals decided is State versus Rubick, in which there was the defendant, Ms. Rubick, was initially charged with possession with intent to deliver cocaine. And the district attorney agreed to a plea of possession because the DA didn't feel that her involvement was of a sufficient nature to bring it as a felony. The trial court in that case rejected the plea, and that rejection of the plea was upheld by the Court of Appeals. The rationale on the record was that the judge did not feel that a misdemeanor adequately conveyed the severity of the crime, and as a matter of fact, the judge disagreed with the prosecutor's interpretation or assessment of her role in the crime.
Now, your position is that the trial court does an independent review of the plea agreement to see if it's in the public interest.
Correct.
How does the appellate court review the trial court?
The appellate court reviews the trial court under an erroneous exercise of discretion standard. It's absolutely clear that discretionary determinations of the trial court are reviewed using an erroneous exercise of discretion standard. And at least Rubick and Kenyon expressly hold that the decision to accept or reject a plea is a discretionary determination of the trial court.
Assuming you win here, should Judge Grimm preside at a felony trial?
I don't. If Judge Grimm feels that he can impartially preside over the felony trial, I don't believe that there's any statutory or constitutional reason that he shouldn't. If he hasn't been rotated off by this point, I think that he could certainly do that, but I think that would be a decision of Judge Grimm. I'd also like to make a comment on Justice Ziegler's point that I thought was extremely on point, and that is that this happens infrequently. Since 1998, approximately 1.6 million criminal charges have been filed, and since then, since Kenyon was decided, this is the first time this court has been asked to provide additional guidance on how a trial court should exercise their supervisory authority. So what happens in reality and why it didn't happen in this case, I'm not sure. But the DA and the defendant are going to go back and work out a different plea, knowing the judge's concerns. They'll either work out a different plea or it'll be scheduled for trial. But the reality is that plea bargains happen hundreds and hundreds of times a day throughout courts across the state.
As a follow-up to Justice Prosser's question, what do we do then with 757.19, which says a judge shall disqualify himself when a judge is a party or material witness, except that a judge need not disqualify himself if the judge determines that any pleading purporting to make him a party is false, sham, or frivolous? Your time's up.
How convenient.
I saw you pause, so I thought I might as well
dodge that one. Right?
Saved by the red light. If you say my time is up, the chief will say you know the answer. So.
You know, to be honest, I don't know. I certainly, the argument could be made that because the judge has been a party in this case, that he therefore must disqualify himself in any trial that proceeds. I think the general rule is that a judge, this interlocutory appeal certification doesn't happen every day. In fact, it hasn't happened in at least 30 years. And so I honestly can't say. Judge Grimm might feel that it would be best to disqualify himself.
The state, if I may, Chief, the state indicated that maybe we could treat him as an amicus rather than a party. I just didn't quite know about that. But if you have anything else to add, that's fine. And if you don't, that's fine, too.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Ms. Wheeler, what about the argument that three hearings on the prosecutor's discretion and what the law enforcement has said, that he knows too much now outside of regular evidence that would have been presented? And this is one of the problems of judges in civil cases dealing with settlement agreements or settlement conferences, that the judge learns things that the judge would not learn in court, and that can therefore knock the judge off sitting on the case. That's why in many courts you have different judge handling a settlement.
Right.
Does that happen to Judge Grimm here?
I don't think it does. I'm not sure what Judge Grimm would have learned that wasn't already before him on the record.
One of the things is he accepts all of this as true. He accepts the complaint, the information is true. He accepts the search warrant affidavit is true. He accepts all this is true here. Can he do that? Should he be doing that?
I think he's accepting as true the same factors that the prosecutor is accepting as true, and the prosecutor is making his or her decision about entering the plea. Mm-hmm. And I think that in general, the more information, the better, and the public interest analysis is for the judge shouldn't necessarily be limited to different factors than the prosecutor was able to consider.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Field. Freimuth?
Thank you. Taking the last point first, with respect to recusal, I think the statute, now that the judge has been made a party, 757-19, would require his recusal. And even if he were deemed an amicus, which is what the U.S. Supreme Court apparently does when the parties are united against a ruling of a lower court, they appoint an amicus to represent that lower court's opinion. Here, I would hate to see the case come back on a challenge to the judge's impartiality on a further appeal, so that maybe recusal would be the safest route to go here. And you certainly have the mechanism here with the judge being a party, now made a party to the action. With respect to timing, I think the ultimate question here is a question of who decides, whose view of the public interest controls. When it comes to the timing at which a plea agreement has to be made, where the judge's calendar is in play and where the judge's authority is directly involved, I think that's a different question and a different set of standards of review, perhaps, that the issue being, was the judge properly exercising discretion in setting this time limit or that time limit, as opposed to going to the merits of a particular plea agreement that was timely made under the judge's order, which is what the focus is here, I believe. With respect to the trial court's significant reliance on law enforcement views in it. I agree with Justice Bradley that I think that's running through all three of the hearings here, is that the court wanted to know what does law enforcement believe about this, think about this. And I think that's inappropriate. The court should not be soliciting law enforcement views. It would elevate law enforcement above a crime victim, whose views the prosecutor must by statute consider, but which are not in any sense controlling of the prosecutor's decision. The prosecutor here speaks for law enforcement, and that's clear certainly at sentencing in the case law, and I think it's also appropriate here. The prosecutor is the elected official that speaks for the state in these determinations. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Primo. Mr. O'Malley?
Thank you. I don't think it's a radical standard that's being suggested. I think it's a practical standard that's already being applied. It's never been enunciated by the Supreme Court, or really, for that matter, by any court of appeals in Wisconsin. When courts have enunciated it, they've generally gone to the erroneous exercises of discretion standard. I agree with the point that having courts involved in this politicizes courts. It makes a Willie Horton case out of every potential plea agreement they approve of. And a ruling in favor of the state and Mr. Conger in this would basically ameliorate that kind of a problem, I think, very effectively. It should also be noted, and I think the Chief Justice picked up on this, is that there were proof issues in this case. And that was one of the things that the prosecutor looked at and decided that it made a good reason for, one of the good reasons for reducing this case. Those are the points I want to make. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Malley. I want to thank all the counsel, Mr. Freimuth, Mr. O'Malley, Mr. Kempinen, Ms. Wheeler, for their arguments today in a case we haven't seen for many years in terms of judicial review of a prosecutor's decisions on plea agreements. That concludes our hearing in 08AP755-CR, State versus Conger. The court will meet in a conference at 3:20. We are in recess until tomorrow morning when we hear another case.